Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. So, are things moving fast enough for you? A couple of months ago, we thought Gaza and the elimination of Hamas's war-making and governing capabilities was the crucial battlefield, and it was. But then came Israel in Lebanon and the decimation of Hezbollah, and we thought that was bigger, and in fact, it was. But then came the Turkish occupation of northern Syria and the explosion of Sunni jihadist forces, resulting in the collapse of the Assad government and the shaking of the Iranian hold on the region, not to mention shaking the Russian hold on the region. And we thought that was bigger, and it was, and it is, and they're all mixed together, and it all came across the U.S. election, which we are not going to discuss. The good news for us and for you is that our guest today, Barry Shaw of the Israel Institute for Strategic Studies, can cover all of those things, except that last one about presidential elections, which we are not covering. But first, your JPC introduction. The Jewish Policy Center was founded in 1985. That's 30 years next month. Wow. To provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our insight articles, our magazine, In Focus Quarterly, the winter 2025 issue, which is called Iran, Freedom or Fire, will be up on the website and in the mail during the Hanukkah holiday, your gift from us. I also want to suggest that you go back to our winter 2024 and spring 2024 issues for some really important stuff on the American Jewish community and Israel's ongoing battle for the security of its people after October 7th. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Since October 7th, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of the State of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the people of Israel and in bringing Hamas and Hezbollah to justice, whatever justice is, and making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages. And, we have added, working against the malign revival of anti-Semitism in Europe, North America, and of all places, Australia. That one, I have to say, surprises us. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. And now our guest. Barry Shaw is the Senior Associate for Public Diplomacy at the Israel Institute for Strategic Studies. He is everywhere. He contributes regularly to media outlets, including the Jerusalem Post, and he's a frequent speaker at conferences, pro-Israel advocacy events, and I find him on Facebook. I find following Barry Shaw on Facebook to be fabulous. You get all kinds of updated news. He is also an author. He is author of Fighting Hamas, BDS and Anti-Semitism. Also, 1917, From Palestine to the Land of Israel, BDS for Idiots, which is a good one, and my favorite of his works, which is a totally off-subject book, excuse me, entitled A Tale of Love and Destiny. Barry tells the story of Sarah Aaronson, a Jewish heroine, the only woman to lead a major spy ring in wartime right under the nose of the enemy, which was at the time the British Mandatory Authority in Palestine. Since 10/7, Barry has been keeping people up to date on events in Israel and along the battlefields. So I asked him what he wanted to focus on today. Clearly Syria is at the top of the list, but the issue of Syria also involves what he called Ottoman ambitions, which is Turkey and the Muslim Brotherhood, the ambitions of jihadi ISIS and al-Qaeda armies, the ability or inability of al-Jawlani to control them all, Russia, Iran, Jordan, and finally, possibly, good news in Israel's future. So buckle up, everybody. This is going to be a fast one. Barry Shaw, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. And first of all, I want to thank you for the article that you wrote on the subject. I found it absolutely spot on. And one of the two things that have happened since, so I think we'll play catch up. But also, I think we need to give your viewers a bit of a background of what's going on before we can assess precisely what's happening. And I see a lot of various issues here that I want to clarify, and some are quite troubling. I think we have to make an honest appraisal of who controls Syria and what their intentions are. And as I said, I really appreciated your article. And we have to study the character of the new Syria. It's a combination of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Turkey's Erdogan, a ruler's long-held ambition of restating a 21st century version of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, of course. And the other thing that's troubled me is I find the same defect in Western left socialist imagery in completely misjudging what's going on in Gaza and Lebanon in the past. And now they seem to be applying the same thing in Syria. It's confusing the facts and the truth and the details and making it fit a sort of progressive left-wing imagery, which is wrong. So if we put it in simple terms for the Western media and Western politicians, I would put it simply put, Assad dictator in bad, and now Julali liberator good. That's their version. But actually, Assad dictator was bad, and Al-Jalali liberator is possibly even worse. So, a part of what I want to get over in this broadcast, Shoshana, with your permission, is really to re-educate and re-inform the people of the left who have been wrong for the last year or so, ever since, let's say, the 8th of September, October. I'm giving them a day's grace because they were shocked by the 7th of October, but what they've done since the 8th of October has been simply shocking. And their perspective of things is wrong. So let's press on and let's need to understand who drove out Assad with an honest assessment of the background and where it's heading. So the man who calls himself Abu Muhammad al-Julali was arrested in Iraq, by the way, in 2006 by US forces. And he was sent to Abu Ghraib prison, where he met no less than al-Baghdadi, the founder of ISIS. And he was a member of ISIS before he became a member of al-Qaeda. I'm racing through a lot of these things just so to emphasize the background and where we're getting. And he controlled, when he began his campaign to remove Assad as the leader of Syria, he captured the town of Idlib, which is a city of 5 million people. And he established there a mini state under Sharia law called the Syrian Salvation Government. Now, after President Trump destroyed ISIS, al-Julali decided to change the image, projecting himself as a moderate ruler supporting law and order. But if he dug deep enough, and again, the Western politicians didn't do this, and neither did the media, that you will find that those living under him these days accusing him of silencing opposition, targeting journalists, imposing harsh restrictions. He ruled like the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I describe him as a dangerous militant jihadi terrorist trying to project an image of himself in the West as an Islamic male version of Joan of Arc. That shouldn't fool anybody, because quite frankly, what you're seeing in the media and by a lot of the politicians is they're projecting him as basically a savior of Syria. Just like, but it's wrong. It's the wrong imagery. It was the same wrong imagery, Shoshana, that we saw over here that they gave to Yasser Arafat, who lied about everything in order to deceive the West, in order to get their money, in order to pursue his political and his terrorist aims. He lied, Arafat lied about his name, lied about his real imagery, and we're seeing exactly that with the man who calls himself al-Julali. So I want to put a few truths to al-Julali. Al-Julali was born in Saudi Arabia in 1982. And his father was of Syrian parents. His father was in the oil business, and his mother was a geography teacher. Now, in a 1921 interview he gave to the American PBS, Shoshana, he claimed that his family originated on the Golan Heights, and therefore he changed his name to Abu Muhammad al-Julali. That, again, is a fiction. It's not his real name. But we see this, as we saw with people like Arafat. They change their clothes, their names, their identity to suit the passing moment. Now, he also claimed that his grandfather fled the Golan Heights in the 1967 Six-Day War. So don't tell me this in his jihadi, Al-Qaeda, ISIS mind, that he doesn't harbor any anti-Israel grievances as a Syrian defeated in a war that they initiated, three wars to destroy Israel. Syria attacked Israel in 1948, in 1967, and 1973. And he's putting it out as if Israel was the oppressor and his family had to flee from the Golan Heights as a grievance against Israel. So his real name is not Al-Gulani or Al-Julali. His real name is Ahmed Hussein Al-Shara. That is his true name. Now, in 2016, Al-Julali announced his organization's withdrawal from Al-Qaeda, changed his name to Jabhat Fateh Al-Sham. And in a first appearance on camera, he decided, said to provoke no excuse to the international community led by the United States and Russia to bomb, expel all Muslims in the Levant under the pretext of harming Al-Qaeda affiliated al-Nusra Front. So basically, he changed his identity while attacking not only the United States, but Russia. And then he merged with several, or tried to, with several opposition factors under the new name, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. That's HTS as it's referred to these days. But they didn't join him. So his Al-Tahrir al-Sham, he established a salvation government in Idlib. And in recent days, he's begun publishing under his real name of Ahmad al-Shara. Now, skeptics like me believe that Giuliani presents himself in the organization as moderate. See, because it's as hollow as I said to Arafat, but he's doing it for the same reason. He's doing it to seduce the West and the people that might oppose him, because he needs time, he needs money, he needs fall. So he's going to appeal, and he's getting it from the West, who will end up giving him money, financing him, giving him the money and everything to make himself into a proper terrorist jihadi army, as Arafat did, as Hamas did, as other people have done before. So he needs the time in order to hoodwink the West. That's one of the things he's doing. So, as I said, this is a pretense that we've got to be careful of. And the people who know better are the people who are being executed and pursued today. And the media isn't covering this, because quite frankly, the biggest victim of all so far in the north of Syria are the Kurds, who are being decimated, but also the Christians and also the Druze. And you don't hear anything that's going on. But I have seen, and we in Israel have seen, scenes that are pretty horrific, which I don't believe, because I haven't seen it on any of the Western media, these sort of things, because they're doing a snow job, if you want to put it, because they're promoting this guy as some sort of new messiah to save the Syria from the bad guy Assad. But this is why at the moment we have, for instance, six Druze villages in the Golan Heights area of Hadar who met together without Israel and then asked and requested that their territory that their villages are in will be annexed by Israel as part of an extended buffer zone that we're in right now. I'd like to come back to later on. But what I'd like to do right now is actually turn the attention to who is the main actor of this, and this is Erdogan of Turkey. Erdogan, and I've said for some time, has carried a sort of ambition. He sees himself as the new pasha ruling a new extended Turkey, the new extension of the Ottoman Empire. And if you've read my book, as you mentioned, 1917, From Palestine to the Land of Israel, It's documented here. What were the Ottomans doing as recently, if you want to call it recently, as 1917? Yes, their empire started in Istanbul, but they ruled, wait for this, the countries that are called today Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Israel, Jordan. They weren't called it there. They're all part of the Ottoman Empire. And where did the Ottoman Empire have its seat in order to dictate this landmass? Damascus in Syria. Now, it's all coming together because it was Erdogan who has been helping with arming not only the Turkish army, but also some of the gangs and the terrorist groups from the north of Syria, which helped this al-Julali march where through all the way to Damascus. So he's doing this with the help of both the ISIS and al-Qaeda, that he says, no, I'm not ISIS anymore and I'm not al-Qaeda anymore. I'm just for the freedom for the Palestinian people. Really? Okay. Let's see what's going to happen over the next few years as Erdogan and Turkey extend their influence and their troops inside Syria. You will see one of the biggest embassies you'll see rising up in the capital of Damascus will be the Turkish embassy. Now, this is quite strange because what we had in the last few days was the Turkish foreign minister had the chutzpah, because I don't know the Arab name for that, in order to condemn Israel's military action in Syria and its advance into the buffer zone between Israel and Syria, saying that, and I quote, Israel is displaying its occupation mentality, which is rich, given by a Turkey that has now illegally invaded and occupied, ethnically cleansed large parts of northern Syria since 2016, as well as occupying northern Cyprus. Let's talk about that. Which is against United Nations Security Council Resolution 541. And the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe described the northern part of Cyprus as occupied by Turkey since 1974. So now we have this week, the Turkish foreign minister saying we're occupying Syria. If that's right, foreign minister, get your troops and get your people out of Syria as well, because you're doing exactly that. Now, NATO have also allowed Turkish participation in NATO for one reason and one reason only, to try and appease Erdogan to stop Turkey opening the door, stop the flow of refugees, Syrian refugees and refugees from the rest of the Middle East from flooding into Europe. And basically what they've been doing, as we've seen what happened in Amsterdam and other places is going on now, they are ruining what we assume would be the norms and the normalities of European countries. So we have a situation over here, which I predict is going to happen, is that the first thing that Turkey is going to do when they move their troops into northern Syria, that is going to open the door. And the next thing that Erdogan is going to do is he's going to evict the 3 million Syrian refugees that are being housed in Turkey right now. He doesn't want them. He doesn't need them. He's going to send them back to Syria. And there you've got out of 3 million, quite a hefty loop there, who are going to look on this al-Julali, whoever you want to call him, as a messiah, and will become his soldiers and his henchmen in the future. Now, I'm saying this is going to happen because also Jordan is going to do its best to evict his 45,000 Syrian refugees from there as well. And the West will say, well, this is normal because they are Syrian. But heaven forbid, let's see what happens when Britain, Holland, France, other Germany want to evict their hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees. You're going to get the soft progressive left saying, you can't do things like this. This isn't right. They sowed refuge in your country, let them stay there. So there's a double standard comes up between what I call the liberal left-wing West and the truth of what's going on in a lot of the Arab countries. What is acceptable for Turkey and Jordan to do, and these other countries, are not acceptable for European countries. This is how confused the West is these days. So that is basically the nutshell of how I see the two sort of things development. Now, before we come on to other things, with your permission, I want to go on to one or two news items because these sum up where we are today. Okay. I don't know if you saw yesterday or today, I think it was, Putin was broadcast live from Moscow, which he answered a few questions. And he said, as far as Russia is concerned, A, we were not defeated in Syria. We evacuated 4,000 Iranian military operatives from Syria through an airfield. 30,000 Syrian regime fighters and pro-Iranian militia fled without a fight. Aleppo was occupied by only 350 military operatives, and we are in contact with various groups in Syria. We are discussing the future of our military bases in Syria. We have proposed that the air base in Khmeimim be used to receive humanitarian aid in Syria, which means Russia is trying to find its way back into the good graces of this ISIS jihadi ruler of Syria right now. He said, I'm ready to talk to Trump and meet with him at any time. And a particular quote he said at the end of this press conference, surprisingly, Israel is the main beneficiary of what happened in Syria. That's straight off the boat. Now, I want to give you what is Israel's official policy, and then we can go on to some Q&A. Is that all right, Shoshana?
That's
The
fine.
Israel official policy at Syria in this time is from the Prime Minister's office. We have no interest in a conflict with Syria. We will determine Israeli policy regarding Syria according to reality on the ground. But the IDF came up with something with a bit more specific detail. So the official statement from the Israel Defense Forces are, we are here to defend along the border of the Golan Heights and Mount Hermon. Syria was a country that was an enemy state. Its army collapsed, and there is a threat that terrorist elements will not establish themselves next to our border. We are not intervening in what's happening in Syria. We are unequivocally intervening in what determines the security of Israeli citizens, especially the communities on the Golan Heights, and we're doing that professionally and correctly and with determination. That's the official Israeli position today. I hand it back to you.
Okay, let me pick up on one thing that you said,
Right.
because it's a question I get all the time about Turkey and NATO. Turkey is not what any of us would call a good NATO ally. It's not a good ally of anything. So the question comes to me all the time, why doesn't the NATO organization put Turkey out? And I just want to say that there is no way to do that. It's one of the great flaws of NATO. You need 100% vote to let countries in, as Sweden and Finland discovered a couple of years ago, but you also need 100% vote to put someone out. So Turkey would have to vote for its own expulsion from NATO. It will never do that because it gets military benefits, it gets political benefits simply by being in the organization. So Turkey is in, period, full stop, and we can stop trying to figure out how to get rid of it because we can't get rid of it. So that's just one thing I wanted to lay on the table. I have to say also, I'm glad you quoted that statement by Putin because it's important in many ways. First of all, because you want to know what the Russians are thinking, but also that he says Israel was the beneficiary. I suspect he's right if Israel plays its cards right, because and especially I think if Russia comes back into Syria, Israel and Russia share an aversion for ISIS jihadists. Russia had its own problems with them in Chechnya. They committed war crimes at their elbows in Chechnya. Grozny was at one point considered the most destroyed country in the world by the United Nations. So Russia has no interest in helping ISIS rebels, Sunni rebels, Turkish Muslim Brotherhood. They don't like any of them. The idea that Russia and Israel may find a way forward together if Russia's in Syria, okay, maybe. But the one place we haven't discussed, or you haven't discussed, Barry, I'm going to ask you to discuss it now, is Iran. So Russia left. They took a lot of their stuff and they left their bases, but they want to come back, clearly. Israel, I think, will have no problem with that. Where's Iran? Did they run off into the night? What happened?
Okay, good question. Iran is being scolded by the rebels and by the Syrians that were truly oppressed by Assad, because they know that it was Iran that was giving him the muscle. As you know, we have the situation where Assad, who was he? He was a leader of the Alawites, which are barely what, 16%, 20% maximum of the Syrian people. And he was kept in power by two strong arm guys. One is Russia, and the other one was Iran. So there's a very bad taste, not just off the ISIS people or the Al Qaeda people or Al Julali, but the rank and file Syrians who suffered under Iran. So it's going to be very difficult for Iran to come back. You've just triggered a thought in my mind that I'd like to express. I mentioned to you that obviously Assad was a minority because he was an Alawite. So the people, part of the people who are also going to suffer if they can't get out of Syria and they're still in Syria are the Alawites because they represent Assad and they're in a small minority. But I'd like to expand on something, a thought that I'm developing, and I'm not quite there yet, but I'll express it to you as long as your viewers don't pay attention to it. It's just between you and me. Is my theory is that it's, first of all, it's going to take a few years for this Al-Jilali and the Turks to reconstitute Syria in the way that they want. That's rebuilding it to be a major terror state. This is what it's going to be. It's certainly not going to be a democracy. And I think when they look, they would have two targets. The main targets would eventually be Israel, because quite frankly, a number of his troops have been shouting onto Jerusalem as they were marching towards Damascus, for instance. So it's clearly there, although he will never admit it. However, I have another thought, and it comes back to Erdogan's ambition to reinstate the Ottoman Empire. I think it's quite likely that the first target is not going to be Israel, it's going to be Jordan. And Jordan is the weak link here. Jordan will have to get rid of their 45,000 Syrian refugees who won't thank the king for protecting him there, but they go back. But what's going to happen? There is going to be an infiltration over the border between Syria and Jordan. A lot of bad actors in Jordan are going to be given arms and training, and you're going to have some of the Al-Jalali's people infiltrating into Jordan as well, because I think they see that as the weak link. And the King of Jordan is in desperate states of being deposed, because who is the King of Jordan? It's what, 60%, 70% Palestinians, and it's about 10, 12% Hashemite, right? So he's in more of a minority than Assad was. And I can tell you there have been discussions and military discussions between in the last 2 days between the Israeli intelligence and top military people with some top military people in Jordan. So something is cooking here. That people make an attempt on Jordan, the Israelis may come to the defense of the king. But the meeting was also that Israel doesn't want infiltration via Jordan, both of the ISIS and Al-Qaeda people, and to be infiltrated through Jordan across our border, which is a long, empty space, if you like, very difficult to defend, much more difficult even with the Gaza border or the Lebanon border to come over through the Jordan Valley. That could wreak havoc for Israel. So we're aware of a danger coming from there. So I think that's one of the weak spots right now.
So I agree with you that Jordan is a weak spot. And just because we're doing it, let's throw one more piece in there. Jordan has been a conduit for weapons over Syria into Jordan and into Judea and Samaria,
Correct.
which fosters the problem of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and all of those guys on Israel's border.
Yeah.
So you not only have Jordan, you have the river, you have Judea and Samaria, and all of those are susceptible to the importation of weapons. So, would you expect to see more of that in the next couple of years?
Absolutely. I think Israel has to invest heavily in a more fortified, long, long border between us and Jordan, because, as you quite rightly mentioned, this Jordan rubs up against the Red Sea, against across Aqaba's across the water from Eilat. It's across from the Dead Sea, you want to put it that way, not the Jordan Valley. And Israel is very susceptible on that border, probably even more so than from Gaza and Lebanon as well. So, I mean, we could see if any major forces were coming. But again, like you said, terrorist attacks coming through there, but also weapons smuggling that is going on right now into, as you again quite rightly said, through Judea and Samaria and into the hands of the people under the Palestinian Authority, arming them. There was an event going on yesterday of us having to take out some terrorists again in Tulkarm and Jenin and things like this. This is a daily incident, which is only going to get worse. And those weapons, as you rightly said, are coming across the border from Jordan, but coming from Iraq and through Syria.
So here's where I start to worry. I believe that some of this was good news. Anything that weakens Iran, in my opinion, is good news if it's played right. That's all good stuff. But if Israel has to defend the king of Jordan, and there are people who said, well, why didn't Israel get rid of Assad? Why doesn't Israel take care of the Red Sea and the Houthis? Why doesn't Israel take care of Iran? Israel's not a very big country. And at some point, it seems to me, Israel runs out of the capability to run the whole region, and it needs something else. And what it really needs is the United States. So you have Israel in CENTCOM, and the relationship between U.S. Central Command, which is CENTCOM, and Israel is excellent. The relation with the commanding general of CENTCOM, General Kurilla, is very, very good. But at some point, doesn't Israel need real cooperation with the United States to manage all these bits?
Absolutely, it does. And Israel is in a dilemma right now because, quite frankly, we've got this thing. And my assessment is that I think Israel will be looking at Syria as a slow boiling problem. I think Israel will say we've got sort of time on our side to see what's developing in Syria. In the meantime, we have a more major problem to deal with, and that's to do with Iran. Iran, as you know, was one of the major losers of what happened in Syria, and some religious folks over here in Israel would say it's almost like something mystical and holy that went on. The actual fall of the House of Iranian Cards, with both what we did succeeded in doing in Gaza with Hamas, followed by some miraculous, what I called it, that intelligence work against the Hezbollah, from everyone from the top honcho of Hezbollah down to all the leading commanders, even to the middle ground with the bleep, the beepers and the walkies and things like that. So in other words, Iran has been triple punched, both with regard to Hamas, with regard to Hezbollah, and also with being kicked out of Syria right now. And that was, of course, for the main flow of weapons from Iran to Syria with Assad's approval and into Hezbollah in Lebanon. So that's dried up and everything. But however, the problem with Iran remains. And I see already Iran is playing, they're the world experts in market tradery and chess, and they're playing a very smart game with regard to the incoming administration. Is they're trying to schmooze up, if you want to put it that, to the American administration, both to the current administration and to the new one, saying, let's talk, we don't have anything to argue about, we maybe have more to combine that divides us, which of course is a lot of rubbish. They're doing that because they see Trump coming in and they're scared of Trump. The question is Israel going to take out the nuclear facilities before Trump enters the White House or wait until he's in and do it with together with the Americans? Somebody at the top in Israel knows the answer to that. Because I understand Bibi has spoken at least four, five, or six times with Trump already. I don't believe any world leader has had the number of talks with Trump that Bibi has had. And I don't think he's simply talking to him, complaining about the court cases going on in Israel right now. I think he's talking about far more serious issues. So I don't know. We don't know what's going to happen, but I anticipate that something major is going to happen against Iran more than something major is going to happen from Israel towards Syria.
Okay, so let's throw more stuff in here because this is getting really, really interesting.
Okay.
Israel deals with Iran, or Israel and the United States deal with Iran, or somebody deals with Iran. But you still have the problem of money and Turkey. Now, money to Turkey is basically money from Qatar to Turkey, which is the same as money from Iran to Turkey. So are we trading? Are we in the West, Israel and the United States and our friends, are we trading Iranian malevolence for Turkish malevolence funded by Qatar? And how much difference will it make?
I agree with you because there was something behind your question. Because I've said, even openly for some time, that Qatar is playing a double-edged game, and Qatar has succeeded to a great extent in miseducating, indoctrinating the future, the current and future generations in places like the United States, Australia, and other things with the money into the ivory towers of American academia, which has suddenly been exposed of being completely rotten and off the track and everything, but they're already developing the decision makers. I think they may be finding that under the Trump administration, the people that they thought they had in the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon are all going to disappear. I meant by that also how it affects also Iran. Is that I made a couple of videos because I have a show called The View from Israel, and I made two or three videos with Iranian exiles. I'm talking about Iranian exiles who generally love the state of Iran and don't play the Iranian Ayatollah game. And in one of the videos I made, I exposed the person. I said that what the Biden-Harris administration has done, which I think one of the biggest crimes, is that some what they call American Iranians, in other words, Iranians who are now living in the United States, have worked their way into the White House, the State Department, and even the Pentagon. And these people have direct personal contacts with the leaders of the Iranian regime, like people like, for instance, the foreign minister. And the prime minister of Iran and some other very notable people. There was one in particular who was in the Pentagon, who in 1914, 1916, sent a letter to the foreign minister saying, I've been invited to a conference in Saudi Arabia and one in Israel. What's your advice? And the advice was, go to the Saudis and ask the other one, forget it. And this is somebody who was high up as an administrator in the US Biden Pentagon.
Yeah, let me point out that person still sits in that chair,
Right.
despite the fact that everybody knows it was public knowledge and never denied by that person. The person remains in the chair. And
The point I would add on that was that the day after I made that video, when it was at the Cannes and it wasn't even up yet, there was a report that a secret document between Israel and the Pentagon had been given leaked out of somebody in the Pentagon. Do you remember?
yeah,
And
and the immediate
I would put
assumption.
my money on a former Iranian and American who was there in the Pentagon.
Actually, it appears that it was not that person.
Right.
Everybody
Yes, I heard.
jumped immediately to that person.
But
Perhaps
did
that
you see?
person was smart enough not to do it. It appears it was someone else. But in keeping with your theory, it was
Right.
a person with ties to Iran. It was not just some Pentagon employee with no tie to it. I mean, it was a thing. It was a real thing. It may not have been that person, but it was a real thing. So, yeah, we have issues in this country that will need to be addressed. And a lot of them have to do with where people sit, a lot of them have to do with money. that comes in. It turns out that Yale University was taking money from Qatar, which is bad enough, but they weren't reporting it, which is illegal. So we have things that we have to address. I mean, it's not the stuff that you and I can address here, which is, you know, more, I don't know, more international. Speaking of which, there's another name that hasn't come up yet, and I would appreciate it if you bring it up, and that is Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Where are the Saudis in all of this?
The Saudis have been spending far too long sitting on the bleachers criticizing what's going on the field in the game, right? And they keep saying they're cheering for one side, which is like the Palestinians, but they're not getting off the bleachers and getting in the game at all. I think that is bad enough. But you're leading me, I think, into my unique and original concept for the solution for Gaza. Do we have time to cover that? Because Saudi Arabia is part of it. I'll race through it as quickly as I can. Last December, January, when the war was raging, and I put my head in, what's the solution for Gaza? Once we managed to eradicate Hamas, what's the solution for Gaza? And every time I spoke to people in positions here in Israel, decision-making, I said, you know, what do you think of the solution would be? And they would give answers that I could poke holes in. The two solutions apparently come down to this. Either we get rid of Hamas, and then we have to bring in the Palestinian Authority to rule over Gaza, because that's in preference to Hamas, or that Israel takes over. So my answer to that is twofold. If it's Israel taking over, I have to admit something personal to you right now, is that I have a grandson who has been serving in Gaza for about 6 months now. Now, I don't want my grandson patrolling the streets of Khan Yunis or Rafah for the next 20 years, because you still have 2 million Gazan Palestinians there. And I don't want the Palestinian Authority taking over, because quite frankly, the Palestinian Authority made a terrible job and still making a terrible job of the territories they were given to be operate from Ramallah. They've been corrupt. They also support terror. I beat on it all the time about Mahmoud Abbas's pay-to-slay reward scheme, rewarding any Palestinian who kills Israelis. The number of amount of money he gets depends on two things. A, the number of Jews and Israelis he's killed, and the length of his prison sentence. And it includes, by the way, Hamas terrorists or Islamic Jihad terrorists. Politics have no role when it comes to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority rewarding their terrorist killers. And yet this is the state that Blinken and most European countries says we have to have a Palestinian state, which brings me to one fear that I have, and that is the final slam of the door of Biden before he leaves the White House is whether he's going to do an Obama on Israel and call for a United Nations Security Council resolution for decreeing recognition of a Palestinian state, and that Biden will not hold the veto. In other words, he will do what Obama did in when he was going out the door with Biden and his vice secretary, saying that Judea and Samaria are legally occupied Palestinian land. We're hoping that he's not going to take this step, which would be an egregious step. So it brings me back to this notion that quite frankly, the Palestinian authorities who have not succeeded in being prepared to live next door to Israel on the territories that was accorded them according to the Oslo Accord, and not kept to their obligation of the Oslo Accord, are not to be trusted to do the same in Gaza. So what's the solution? And I said an extension of the Abraham Accords. And the Abraham Accords would be a protectorate of what goes on the reconstruction of Gaza. A protectorate is a well-known entity, international entity. And in two cases, protectorates have been applied to do one thing which I says has been essential, because you don't just reconstruct Gaza structurally, you have to reconstruct it ideologically to get rid of the radicalization, which is at the core of what is rotten about the Palestinian movement. And it's not just in Gaza, it's also under the Palestinian Authority. who preach or teach for a world without Israel. This goes on, and this radicalization has to end, and Israel can't do it. It has to be the moderate Muslim states of the UAE and Bahrain, with the addition of Saudi Arabia coming in, to rebuild the mosques and the madrasas and the schools and the infrastructure, but also to employ them, their imams and their teachers, teaching their moderate form of Islam. And the other legs of the Abraham Accords is the United States and Israel introducing a modern curricula in the educational system, which will bring the Gazan people up to a level so they can build a state which will be based on high technology, agriculture, tourism, industry, and Israeli entrepreneurs will be opening data centers and high-tech centers in Gaza City, like Eyal Waldman started to do before his daughter was killed on the 6th of October. So that's how you see the future of Gaza as an Abraham Accords protectorate. And the radicalization was done by the Allies, Britain and the United States in Germany after World War II, where we weren't just reconstructing West Germany, we were also denazifying the Germans. And that took some time as well in West Germany. And it worked there, and it worked with America in Japan as well. Because what did America do to defeat Japan? You had to drop two atom bombs on Japan before they surrendered. But however, America went in there, imposed an American protectorate, temporary protectorate, which helped rebuild Japan, but also de-radicalized the Japanese. And both Japan and Germany have become modern, democratic, wealthy, pragmatic countries. And you have to impose this on Gaza, and Gaza should be the model. It will take about 10, 15 years to do it. But I think Gaza should be the model that could be then reimposed on the Ramallah and the Palestinian Authority. But I don't see a two-state solution. If Blinken says a two-state solution is great, I said, well, maybe a three-state solution is even better. And I said that Gaza should become a new nation, in the United, a member of the United Nations as the state of Gaza, promoted by the Abraham Accord countries. And that would be a model of a new Middle East.
So admitting that I'm old, okay, I have to admit that I'm old. I remember at the very beginning of the Oslo Accord process, there was something called the Gaza-Jericho plan, which was because, precisely because, it was believed that Gaza at the time was a more moderate space than Judea and Samaria, and you could start there. But let me add a couple of things to what you're saying. I'm totally in line with you. And along those lines, I would point out first that if there is a protectorate, it cannot be an American protectorate. Nobody in the United States would go for it. And therefore, the idea of Abraham Accords countries or Abraham Accords plus Saudi Arabia, much better idea culturally, linguistically, and all kinds of other ways. And both the Saudis and the Emirates and Bahrain, all of them, have had experience rooting out radicalism in their educational systems. So it makes them good. And the other thing is, UAE has always wanted a port on the Mediterranean. They are building a railroad across the land and across Saudi Arabia that's going to cross into, is the goal is, the hope is, cross into Israel and go to Ashdod or Ashkelon. But it could easily go to Gaza. They can employ Gazans. It makes a lot of sense to look at the Abraham Accords countries as partners. And then I would say to Jewish Policy Center readers and readers of InFocus magazine, go back to, I think it's winter 2024, and read Dr. Eliyahu Richter, who wrote about excising toxic politics from spaces. He wrote a fabulous article because he is an expert in excising toxic chemicals from places. And how do you do it? And how do you have to cover the area? So go back and read Dr. Richter because it's useful. Barry, I want to get to one more thing because we are coming to the end. And people that listen to the program know that I like to go out on a positive note. And you provided one yesterday or today about the economic situation of Israel. There are people who think that Israel cannot do this and remain the first world country that it is, that this is going to sap Israel and throw it into poverty. And you had some statistics on your Facebook page that say that that is not quite true. Can you talk to us in short form about Israel's economy at the moment?
Yeah, I haven't got the figures with me right now, but there was a report that came out about 4 or 5 days ago, which gave an amazing report about what has been happening through 2024, certainly when it comes to high tech and artificial intelligence, about the investment that that's coming to Israel and the development of Israeli companies have been absolutely astounding in 2024, which is like another modern miracle, if you want to put it that way, because I know people in high tech, and unfortunately, a lot of high tech companies are missing some of their major engineers and entrepreneurs and people because they've been serving in the army, either in Gaza or in Lebanon. Companies have been investing more than ever before in 2024, and some of these startups are now coming up with some original things that will be used in what we call the third industrial revolution, which is one called artificial intelligence and high tech that's led by companies like Nvidia. I just happen to know my wife is a friend of whose husband is a brilliant guy who came up with patents for a company called Broadcom and then moved over to Nvidia and then came back to Israel. And basically, Nvidia opened up a place in Yokneam here in Israel because they wanted his brains. And he has been working since then for Nvidia. Nvidia is the number one stock on the US stock market, for instance, right? The future of everything. So this is absolutely incredible what's going on. But this is the spirit of Israel. This is what makes us so brilliant. It's not just that suddenly, you know, Iran is supplying Hezbollah with 3,000 or 4,000beepers that sort of all explode at the same time and say, how the heck did Israeli intelligence do something like that? We're a high-tech nation. We do these sort of things. I mentioned Eyal Waldman, who, for instance, wanted to put it Mellanox. He sold Mellanox to Nvidia for so many billion dollars, and he was in the process of opening up a high-tech center in Gaza before Hamas decided they didn't need one and they wanted to destroy Israel. And that on that day, unfortunately, his daughter and his boyfriend got killed. Eyal Waldman could be encouraged to come back to Gaza and to reinvest and work for and invest on a new future for Gaza. So just coming full circle about, you said you don't, as an American, agree with protectorates. I would ask you, Shoshana, go to your record books and see how many protectorates the United States has these days. I think you'll be surprised.
I won't be surprised. I'm just telling you, there is not going to be any enthusiasm for a protectorate in the Middle East at this point. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't.
I had a talk with a diplomat yesterday on the phone. I won't embarrass him by giving his name, but he's well known. And he said it won't work because of this. So I said, so what's your solution? And there's deathly silence on the other side of the phone. I said, you've been in the business of diplomacy for the last 20, 25 years. What's your solution? And then you're an Israeli. And he couldn't get it.
The thing about Americans is that we tend to be without solutions. So I like yours. I mean, I really do. I think the concept of a protectorate, we're going to go explore that as we go forward, because I think that makes sense for the people.
I've got to jump in here. I'm going to shock you to your boots, right?
Go ahead.
And you're
go
going
ahead.
To say, never, never, a million years. I go so far. Somebody was left-wing and sort of center-right these days, but not far-right or far-left or anything. And I have the person who will be groomed to be the Secretary-General of this Abraham Accords Board of Regional Development for a new model of Gaza. And that person is a man called, you're going to be shocked, Mohammed Dahlan.
I'm shocked.
The history of Mohammed Dahlan was that he is a Palestinian who was born where? Khan Yunis. Where's Khan Yunis? In Gaza. He became a strong man under the Palestinian Authority under Arafat, right?
Right.
And he was a strong man that after the elections, for instance, was chosen to lead the Fatah PLO people against Hamas to reclaim Gaza because Hamas disagreed with the election that they won. And actually, they lost. So basically, Mohammed Dahlan was a loser in Gaza against Hamas. But however, he had a falling out with Arafat over policy because he understood that Arafat was being deceptive and he didn't really want to have a proper peace. And Mahmoud Abbas had an argument with him. And then the Palestinian Authority were going to have an election. And Mahmoud Abbas saw that the polls that came out and Mohammed Dahlan was bound to win the election to be president of the Palestinian Authority. And Mahmoud Abbas put out a rumor, a lie, that Dahlan was the person that actually fed the poison to Arafat that killed him. And so, in order to save his life, he ran away. Where did he run away to? The United Arab Emirates, where he became a businessman and a billionaire. And he was like this with the Crown Prince of Bahrain. He's like this with the Crown Prince of the Emirate, and he's like this with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And he was also in his day negotiating Camp David for the Palestinians, so he met the American administration and the Israeli administration. So it would be
Okay.
great to bring somebody, a Gazan, back to Gaza who has one ambition. I am going to be the man that would reform Gaza and make it the new modern state of Gaza, and the hell with Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah.
So I'm going to stop you there because, as I said, I like to go out on a positive note, and that's really the best note I could imagine. You've done a great job, Barry. I appreciate it. I don't know anybody else who could take 17 threads of political and military operations and put them into a coherent package, and you did that. So thank you. But the best part is the idea that someone like Mohammed Dahlan could come back from the depths and end up
This will only work
a
under Trump.
positive figure for the
This will
people of
only work under
Gaza.
Trump. It will
Yeah.
only work under Trump and the person he appoints to be
No. We had
envoy.
an we have an agreement. We're not discussing the president, or any American politics. Thank you. But the idea of an Abraham Accords protectorate, financed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia, managed by a guy like Dahlan, who has his strong roots in the community, overseen ultimately security-wise by Israel, has to be. If I were a Palestinian, I would have to say, you know what? Nothing has worked since my great-grandfather, okay, to my father, to me, to my kids, doesn't work. Got to do something new. And if we get that far, that's a positive. So, Barry,
Can I
thank
add
you.
one final thing as another
Go ahead,
positive thing?
final word.
Very quickly. Okay. Several years ago, when Israel was in Gaza, when Israel was developing Gaza, there was a plan adopted, a project of an offshore airport and marina, with a bridge going from this offshore into mainland Gaza, right?
Right.
This was a major project that Israel was dreaming of because we thought Gaza would be an extension of Israel, and it has all the benefits of possibly being the Côte d'Azur of the far Middle East, if you like, or well, of that. The potential there is enormous. And you know who was the man who drafted that proposal?
Nope.
An Israeli politician by the name of Israel Katz.
Really?
And who is Israel Katz today? He's Israel's defense
Foreigners,
minister. He
defense
was the
minister.
foreign minister, but Bibi made him the defense minister when he got rid of Gallant. And yet that project is there. If people go to my website, you can see it. So we were dreaming big when we were just scratching around and trying to turn Gaza into a paradise before the world said, get out of there. You wonder we only give it to the Palestinians, and it was Arik Sharon, a right-wing prime minister, that uprooted all the 9,000 Jews and said, get out of Gaza. We won't give peace a chance.
So we're going
So.
to give peace a chance because we really have to get off the air in a minute. We're going to end on that note. We are going to give peace a chance. We hope that all of this works because there are amazing possibilities for our listeners. Thank you for tuning in. We are off for the next 2 weeks. So allow me to wish you all a happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas. whatever you celebrate, a happy secular new year. And we'll be back in the beginning of January with a lot more things to talk about. And again, Barry Shaw, thank you.
And shalom from Israel.